history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are men and women around you who have some pretty extraordinary stories to tell if we only take the time to listen. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a lot. We are educated, we're always entertained, and so often inspired by these stories. And I don't think we can squeeze all the stories in today from the legendary Air Force career of General Robert Titus. Earthquake, as he's known to some. We'll see if we can figure out where that nickname came from. But let's go back. I know you just celebrated your 90th birthday here in Colorado Springs, Colorado, home, of course, of the Air Force Academy. But take me back to your childhood. You lived a few different places on the East Coast. Do you remember early on getting fascinated or enthralled with the idea of aviation?
Well, early on, I suppose, was about my first flight in an airplane. I guess I was about 7 years of age when my father took me out to visit an airfield locally in Hagerstown, Maryland, where I started the third grade. Moved there when I was 7 years old. There was a fellow with a Waco single-engine biplane, two open cockpits, and I sat in my father's lap in the back cockpit, and that was the experience. I thought it was a good idea. I remember walking past the post office on the way home from school, and there was a big poster out on a board in front saying, "Be a flying cadet." And there's a picture of airplanes over Randolph Field, Texas. I thought that seemed like a good idea. And, of course, I grew up reading G8 and his Battle Aces and Eddie Rickenbacker in the Flying Circus. But opportunities seemed distant, and I didn't dwell on that. In my recollections, I was aware of the fact that it would be a great thing to do to get up in airplanes. But it was sometime later that the opportunity came to me.
Well, I'm kind of struck by the irony here because I think about all the pilots I've talked to over the years who chuckle at paratroopers and say they don't know why anyone would want to jump out of a perfectly good airplane. And you started out as a paratrooper, ended up as a legendary pilot. And if you would have listened to everybody else, I guess you would have been in the Navy because you went to high school in a Navy town.
I did indeed. But I had no interest in being in the Navy, to tell you the truth. I actually enlisted in the chief petty officer, loaded up with gold braid, talked to me about how I was going to enjoy the Navy, and I told him I wasn't interested in the Navy, as I say. So he sent me off to infantry basic training, which was fine with me. They were looking for paratroopers, and actually I was a bit too tall. The limit was supposed to be 6 foot, and so I kind of scrooched down on the scale, and the sergeant was saying, "Oh, no, you got to stand up straight." And the captain said, "No, we'll take him." So I went through jump school, and I ended up in the 82nd Airborne Division. The war ended while I was in training. The 82nd had redeployed from Europe to Fort Bragg, North Carolina, and I marched in the World War II Victory Parade, never having heard a shot fired or been overseas. The 82nd was the World War II Victory Parade from Washington Square in New York all the way up to Central Park. Great event.
Well, those are some memories for you. Speaking of memories, how about December 7th, 1941? Were you in Norfolk that day?
I was. We were walking. I and a couple of my buddies were walking along and heard about it on the radio, I suppose. And we were talking about how we were going to beat the Japs and so on. We walked by an apartment building, and a woman opened a window and said, "You boys don't understand what war is all about. This is not interesting. This is not a good thing." Mm. And we were chagrined, I guess, by our immaturity. But, you know, we were fired up because, as all young men, think there's some glorious opportunity in a war. Mm. Little did we know.
Well, you have perspective on multiple wars now, but you mentioned marching in that victory parade, and that had to be quite a sight. I mean, to see the people lined up on the streets of New York, I can't imagine how unique that was. Was there some disappointment on your part that you didn't get to go overseas and be a part of it?
Well, I was looking forward to it. In fact, at Fort Bragg, we were lining up to, before I went, the 82nd came back, before the war ended, we were in advanced airborne training in the Alabama area of Fort Benning. They were forming up a new airborne division, presumably to jump into Japan. And I recall, again, on the radio, hearing about the atomic bombs going off, and figured, that's probably a better deal. I don't know that I would have enjoyed jumping into combat in Japan.
Well, And you have perspective from what you did in Korea and Vietnam and time in the Pentagon and at the highest levels of our military. But when you look back on that, do you feel that the atomic bomb and President Truman's decision saved your life?
I can't say that I ever gave it any consideration. Had the opportunity presented itself, I'd have been happy to go with the troopers, I suppose, and engage in combat and try to win the war. That's what we were being trained to do, and I don't think that very many of us were anxious to go or uninterested, but, you know, we'd have done what we were told to do.
Well, and I guess you didn't know at the time either that eventually you would have the chance to come down behind enemy lines and fight your way back across. Not that that's what your plan was.
No.
How did you go from 82nd Airborne to Air Force pilot?
Well, when I got out of the Army, I went to Virginia Tech to study engineering. I was ready to get out of there. I met an Air Force recruiter, and he said, "We're looking for pilots." And they offered me an opportunity to go to pilot training. Okay, if I could pass the physical. I said, "What's the deal?" I said, "Well, we're looking for pilots. We'll put you into pilot training. If you make it, we'll keep you and give you a commission. And if you don't, we don't want you." And I thought, my goodness, this is a no-brainer for me. You're going to teach me to fly, and if I flunk out, I just go home. No charge, no commitment. I'll sign up. And that's what happened. I went through pilot training and was commissioned and got my wings. And shortly thereafter, they gave a war for me, as I saw it.
How did you receive that news of war?
I was in New York. I had flown up there in a P-51 Mustang to meet a girl that I knew. And the following Sunday, I was ready to leave town. And I was headed out to Floyd Bennett Field, where I'd parked the airplane. And I heard the news that the war started in Korea. And I was anxious to get involved. And I kept applying. It took me about a year before they finally, I was essential where I was told. We were flying Mustangs and making blips for a radar controller school down at Tyndall Air Force Base in Florida. I kept going over to personnel saying, "I want to sign up for an assignment in the war." Well, finally, a year or so later, I got orders to go to Luke Field and shoot a little gunnery and then head over to Korea. As it turned out, I got waylaid and sent to Japan for about 3 months. And again, I was still trying to get into the war in Korea, and I kept contacting friends of mine over there. And finally, a fellow by the name of Rock Brett, who was the ops officer of one of the fighter squadrons, went to his group commander, who in turn put in a name request for me. As a result of that, I got called in by the colonel, who my group commander, and told me that I was going out of channels, and that was totally unauthorized and unacceptable. He said, "However, you've got the group gunnery records. Maybe you can do some good over there, so I'm going to let you go."
Why was that so important to you? Why did you so doggedly pursue that assignment?
I had in my blood the image of myself as a fighter pilot, and fighter pilots do what they do in war. And as I said, when I was a kid, I read lots of books, G8 and His Battle Aces and Eddie Rickenbacker, Fighting the Flying Circus, and I just felt that's where I should be. As long as there was a war and I was a pilot and I was a fighter pilot and what I considered to be a pretty good fighter pilot, I wanted to be involved. I thought that was my job.
And you have flown most of the fighter aircraft that the Air Force has had in its nearly 70-year history as the U.S. Air Force. Are you still kind of partial to that Mustang?
Oh, yeah. As I tell my good friend up in Denver, who's a tax attorney and owns a Mustang and races at Reno, he also owns a Sea Fury, and he asked me one time what I thought of the Mustang, and I told him, what else can you think of about it when you understand it's the best airplane that God ever allowed to be built? Yeah, it's a great airplane, and that and the Sabre jet were my favorite.
Well, and you flew them both in Korea, 101 combat missions in Korea. Do I have that number right?
So I understand. I didn't pay much attention, but they told me you already flew 100 and you got to go home.
What kind of missions were those? I mean, that's a lot. That's
flying the Mustangs, it was mostly ground support and interdiction, flying up the main supply routes, looking for trucks or anything coming down into the battle area to keep the supplies from the enemy getting to the front. And a lot of close air support for the Army on the ground and the Marines, dropping bombs and napalm and strafing to assist our comrades on the grounds, and a very noble mission. Close support is a very fine mission because you work so close to the troops, we used to say. The 40s and 50s will get you in the coolant, and then the day's over.
How did you handle that, the pressure and precision that those kind of missions required?
You know, you just get yourself, your teeth into it, as it were. You're so intent on providing the best support you can and keeping the enemy suppressed and their fire suppressed, that you just get into it. It's like when you're playing football. You get into the game, and you're just one with the environment. You just get yourself so heavily involved in it that you haven't got anything else better to do. You just want to do the best you possibly can.
I'll apologize in advance for asking any dumb questions, but it occurs to me in a situation like that where you're providing such close support for ground troops that there's that ever-present possibility of friendly fire, injuries, and deaths. Was that something that weighed on you?
Well, you were very careful. I mean, you talked to the forward air controller on the ground who'd be there with the Jeep, and they laid out some colored panels to identify their position, and they were pretty precise in identifying where you could put the ordnance and what you needed to avoid. I never had any problem in finding the target. I know that were friendly fire incidents. I was never associated with such activity. I suppose that there's some guys in the situation get careless by virtue of the fact that they're concerned for their own safety and welfare. But I didn't allow that to influence my attitude.
How did you feel about your own safety and welfare? Did you think you were doing something dangerous?
You know, sometimes you get butterflies in your belly on the way to the target, but when you get to where you're, when you get into the hostile environment, again, you're so busy, you're so involved, you haven't got time to think about your own personal welfare. It's just not within the equation of your thought process.
And you had targets, but you were a target. How frequent was anti-aircraft fire from the ground or maybe even enemy fighters?
Well, no enemy fighters when we were flying Mustangs down at the... They were too far away. There were some that had occasionally been involved with that activity before the stabilized the demilitarized zone, as it was when I was there. So there was no evidence or any indication of enemy aircraft activity, but there was an awful lot of ground fire, and I got hit quite a few times. Every time I bring the airplane home, the sergeant would be looking at it, and he'd look at me and say, "You got my airplane, a hole in my airplane again, sir." And say, "Sorry about that."
Did that ever get to you? The holes in the airplane? Realizing how many there were or where they were and how close you came to being shot down?
I remember one incident where I felt the blast of some kind of a projectile, and the airplane bounced, and I smelled cordite, and I thought, I'm done. And I called my wingman and said, I'm hit, and I'm headed out. And I looked at all my instruments. Everything was fine. I thought, what in the world is this? I had some rockets on board, and I thought, well, I'm going back and shoot up that target again. And I did. But apparently there's no damage to the airplane. It's the strangest thing. Only experience I ever had like that. You know, it startled me.
Sure.
You know, trying to sort out what I was going to do. I wasn't terrified of anything, as I recall. When you get it and you have to bail out, then you do that too.
Did you ever have to do that in the 51?
Yeah, I got hit, and I didn't realize I was hit until the engine started heating up. Obviously, the coolant had leaked out, and had gone and hit the peg, and the airplane started to burn, and I was forced to bail out. I just went out over the edge, and I was a lot lower than I thought I was, apparently, because I pulled the ripcord and the parachute opened and I hit the ground almost all at once. I didn't know where I was. Nobody else saw me bail out. They thought I was gone when I got home. I didn't show up. Anyway, it turns out I was in the DMZ, the demilitarized zone, and I was between the enemy and the friendly forces in this no man's zone. I tried to orient myself and looked up, and there were guys from the north coming toward me, guys in quilted pajamas, and I thought, they're not the right kind of guys for me. I had my .45, and I fired a couple shots, and then I heard a burp gun or two, and I thought, whoa, this is not too good. So I hunkered down in the hole, and then a short time later, I heard a voice that said, keep your head down and crawl this way. A good American voice. The Marines sent out a patrol, laid down suppressing covering fire, and I crawled over and ended up in a bunker and hitchhiked my way home.
Wow. So all these times that you've been there for the ground forces, now they're here for you.
Yeah, they saw me. The airplane crashed and the parachute opened when we hit the ground. They said, boy, that was close. You almost didn't make it. I said, well, almost is not good enough, is it?
Wow.
I got home. The main supply route where they delivered ordnance and supplies to the front lines ran right through my base, K-46. It wasn't very far south of there. And I got home and the guys already, I said, okay, who's got my shaving brush? They already divvied up my stuff.
Were you able to get it all back?
Yeah.
Did that experience change your perspective after that on future missions?
I can't say that had anything to do with it. I mean, I simply accept it. I've been accused all my life of having a very level personality. I never get too excited about anything. I mean...
Not even Air Force football?
Oh, you know how those things go. Yeah, it's always exciting to see something interesting occur. Yeah, I've seen some interesting things, but I can't say that it affected my performance.
His performance, in the eyes of the Air Force, was enough to merit the Distinguished Flying Cross four times over, the Silver Star, even the Air Force Cross, not to mention countless other decorations. And we'll hear about some of those as General Titus transitions from those propeller-driven Mustangs to early Air Force jets when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country, and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes.
Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today is 90 years old, but he sure doesn't sound like it, especially if you hear him singing alongside his wife in their church choir in Colorado Springs, Colorado. When he was in the 82nd Airborne at the end of World War II, nobody would have predicted that this paratrooper would end up as a legendary Air Force general with over 500 combat missions, not to mention ridiculously dangerous work as a test pilot. General Robert Titus is our guest today, and when we left off, he was flying F-51 Mustangs in the Korean War. But before you left Korea, you transitioned to one of the early fighter jets, the F-86 Sabre jet. What was that like?
It was pretty simple. They sent us to southern Japan to go through training on the airplane, all of its systems, hydraulic systems, electrical systems, and so on, so that we'd know what the airplane was all about. My first ride, they gave me a ride in a T-33, two-seat trainer. That was my first time in a jet. When I landed from that, they said, okay, there's a Sabre jet. You can get in that and fly it. We're going to give you 10 hours. If you can't cut it in that 10 hours, then we don't want you. And I think it was my fourth ride when I was flying number 4 in a flight of 4. And we were flying north, and I remember flying over a river and looking down, and I said, that looks like it might be the river that we're not allowed to cross. But we did. Then suddenly we were going in the opposite direction. Leader turned south in a hurry, and I'm strung out number 4. I said, I guess I'm checked out. It looks like we're in the combat area. Anyway, the airplane's in front of me, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I said, no, I'm 4. 3, 2, oh, that one out in front must be a MiG. But the lead had not made any radio call. Turned out that he had radio failure. And the MiG just zoomed up and turned north. And had I known he was going to do that, I think I'd have stayed high and tried to intercept him. But that was my first vision of a MiG and my first combat mission in F-86. And I had about 4 hours of flying time in it.
Yikes. And like you say, nothing really ever gets to you as you describe that. It's no big deal, but listening to it, it sounds like a really big deal. Could you feel the difference in power, in speed, and was that difficult to adjust to?
I'll just have to tell you that prior to that checkout, when I had been in Japan, the group commander sat down at our lunch table with us one day, and he said, I need some jet pilots for the 94 squadron, F-94 squadron. And one of the guys at the table said, I've got some jet time. And the colonel said, how much you got? Oh, I got about 15 hours. He said, oh, okay, you can go to that. Next guy had something like 9 hours. Oh, yeah, you can go join that squadron. I said, I'd like to do it, too. You got any jet time? No, sir. Well, then I couldn't use you. I said, are you going to tell me, sir, that it's harder to fly a jet than it is a Mustang? Well, you have to understand, it's an entirely different concept. And I'm thinking, I don't understand. And I don't know how I'm going to learn to understand. If I can't fly the airplane until I get some jet time, how does that work? Well, it worked differently in combat. Uh-huh. There's the airplane, go fly it. So there was nothing to it. I thought, they've been lying to me. I landed that thing, and I said, this is a kiddie car. It's the easiest airplane I've ever flown.
And so you continued to fly those over there in combat till the end of the war?
Yeah, until I finished 100 missions, and then they sent me home.
Anything about those F-86 missions in Korea stand out?
I never got up airborne. There were any MiGs up other than that first mission. I never saw another MiG, and it seemed like they weren't flying the days I was up. Unfortunately, I was looking for them all over the place, but never had the opportunity to engage MiGs in Korea.
And here you had been in the World War II victory parade in New York City. The Korean War, there was no victory.
No, and it was a shorter war, of course. I recall after the Vietnam War, being in Washington, and somebody saying to me, look at this terrible Vietnam War memorial, 50,000 troops, and that terrible. And I said, well, it took 10 or 12 years to do that. Have you ever been over to Gettysburg? It's only about an hour's drive. You can see what we did to one another in 3 days. So war's bad.
Korean War comes to an end. Was there any disappointment on your part with the way it ended?
No, not really. You know, the only disappointment was when I got home and read the newspaper that the MiGs were up and guys were, friends of mine were shooting down MiGs. I thought, I left too soon. But other than that, you know, the war went on for another year. And when it ended, I was pleased. I thought it was a lousy war, but then I guess I feel that way about all wars.
Yeah. Well, does that mean that you enjoyed being a test pilot more than flying in combat?
Oh, I enjoyed flying test, and I was fortunate to be able to get that kind of a job. I flew aircraft across the North Atlantic to NATO countries for a year or so before I got orders to go to the test pilot school. That was a feather in my hat. It was something that I was seriously interested in. I accidentally found out that there was a test pilot school when I was stuck at BW-1 in Greenland. We had ferried aircraft, as I say, we were taking them to Europe via the northern polar route. It was before we had aircraft in-flight refueling, so we were doing hopping from base to base. We'd leave Bangor, Maine, and fly to Goose Bay, Labrador, and from there to BW-1 in Greenland, North Sarsawak, Greenland, and from there to Keflavik, Iceland, and then down to Prestwick, Scotland, and from there over to the continent, be it to Norway or Denmark or Holland or Belgium or France or wherever we were delivering the aircraft. Anyway, we were stuck in Greenland. We had lost four airplanes between Goose Bay and Greenland one day and lost a couple of pilots. Anyway, we were stuck there while they were doing the accident investigations, and I was bored beyond reason. We didn't have anything to do all day long, play bridge and ping pong until they opened the bar, and then enjoy the bar for a few hours. Wake up in the morning, play ping pong and bridge till the bar opened. I went down to the headquarters building and started looking at personnel regulations, and I found out about the test pilot school. And I filled out an application and sent it off on a teletype machine right then and there. A couple of months later, I was told that I was accepted to the test pilot school. Now, I, in the meantime, read up on what I could find in magazines and books and so on. So I graduated from the test pilot school, and I was fortunate enough to be able to stay there at the Air Force Flight Test Center. Actually, I was assigned to the parachute test group, so I did some more jumping with them. In the meantime, I was flying a lot of airplanes, and it was a great experience.
That was at Edwards?
Yeah. It's referred to now as the golden days of flight test. We learned a lot that we didn't know anything about. We lost airplanes in the process. We learned about pitch up. We learned about adverse yaw. We learned about what we shouldn't be doing with airplanes that were pretty iffy.
Do you have to be a little nuts to volunteer for that duty?
No, you just have to be fortunate enough to be able to do the academics and understand the processes. And if you have a little skill, you can stay alive.
Was that kind of exciting for you to do something that no one else had done before?
Yeah, I thought it was great. I thought we had the best job in the Air Force. We had 10 fighter pilots in flight tests. While I was there, we lost 15. People say, how do you lose 15 out of 10? So you keep getting new guys.
It's like those infantry units in World War II.
Pretty much.
So I know that you tested a lot of different jet aircraft, but I read that you had a zero-length launch test where an F-100 is rocketed from a truck bed by a 300,000-pound thrust booster attached to the fuselage.
Actually, it was 130,000 pounds of black propellant. Yeah, it was.
What does that feel like?
It's a 4G acceleration. When you pull the trigger, you're already in full military power, and you stroke the afterburner, and now you've got all the power that the airplane's capable of generating, but you're held in position by some shear bolts, which don't shear until that 130,000 rocket booster lights off. And that just shoves the airplane forward and runs it out to about 275 miles an hour in 4 seconds. So it presses you back against the seat pretty strongly, like an elephant stepped on your chest.
Yeah.
And then you're flying. The rocket drops off of its own accord. The airplane is flying. Yeah, it was a very interesting flight test program.
And are you conscious that whole time?
Oh, sure. You don't. Transverse G's are no problem at all. Not like pulling the G's, you drain all the blood out of your head and into your G suit.
You know about that, too.
Yeah, I'm afraid so.
And what's this transpolar flight from England to the U.S. in an F-100?
I was given two aircraft, two F-100s. They had an analog computer installed, which was a dead reckoning computer, which presumably would give you an ability to move from point A to point B and follow the indication of the arrow, because the computer simply figured out your position. You'd plug in where you wanted to go, and it would give you that indication. And I thought, I've got to do something with this. What can I do? And I thought about a polar flight, because we were told you can't navigate in the polar area because you don't have the capability, you don't have all the necessary equipment, you don't have a sextant, you don't have this, you don't have that. And fighter pilots are too dumb to be able to navigate anyhow. But, of course, we know better than that.
And this is 1959, a long time ago. And this was your idea?
Yeah, I had these two airplanes, as I say, and I thought, well, a polar flight might be a good idea. So I had a tech rep, and we got together, and I laid out some polar charts on the ground and figured, well, I'll just put a grid over them, a grid overlay, and then I can tell the computer, okay, we'll start here, and we want to go there, and it'll solve the equation. And, well, there's a guy by the name of Charlie Blair. He's a famous navigator pilot who had done a P-51 flight over the pole from Norway to Alaska a couple of years prior to this. And he came out to Edwards on some other business, and I invited him over to the house for dinner, and I put my charts on the floor and showed him what I'd like to do. And he thought it was a great idea. And he said, well, you got two airplanes. Can I fly the other one? I said, I guess you can. And so we got the program approved, and that was an arduous process because my boss said, no, we don't want to do that. That's somebody else's job, not a flight test job. His boss thought it was a good idea. His boss didn't, and we're going. Finally, I'm talking to the general who asked me a question about it and invited me to his office, and he called Charlie Blair. Charlie Blair was a great guy. He was married to Maureen O'Hara, by the way.
Oh, really?
The movie actress.
Yeah.
That happened later. And anyway, we did this flight. He turned 50 while we were doing the flight, and then we managed to do the trip. It was a 9.5-hour flight, and we were arrived at Anchorage, Alaska, 1 minute off the projected arrival time.
Did you see anything along the way or encounter any surprises?
No, it was a piece of cake. Getting the flight approved was the hard thing. I was told by the navigators at the headquarters in Washington, D.C. that, well, you can't navigate in the North Pole, you know, magnetic compass doesn't work. I said, yeah, I know that. Well, how are you going to navigate? I said, I'm going to use a directional gyro. Well, the directional gyro has random precession. I said, yes, I know that. Well, what are you going to do about that? And I said, I'll update it with a sun compass. What do you know about a sun compass? I said, I take a picture of the sun, and I look at the almanac and reset the gyro. Well, what are you going to do? How are you going to do that in weather? I said, there's not going to be any weather at 35,000 feet. It was an interesting experience. What was most interesting about it was I went from the headquarters out at Andrews Air Force Base to the Pentagon, where I was going to meet Charlie Blair. And Charlie was in the office of the Assistant Secretary of the Air Force for Research and Development. And I went into the lobby of the Pentagon, picked up the phone to call that office, and I intercepted a telephone call. And it was Dick Horner, the president, the guy who's the Assistant Secretary of the Air Force, talking to General Anderson, who's the head of the Research and Development Command. And he's saying, Sam, this is Dick Horner. I got Charlie Blair in my office, and he and his Captain Titus, from test pilot from Edwards, want to do this flight, and your people turn him off. I don't know anything about that, but I'll sure put an end to that. Anyway, I went up to Horner's office. As I went in the door, out came Charlie Blair and said, we've been approved. I said, I know. What do you mean you know? How do you know? I said, I know that the telephones aren't secure.
And am I correct in interpreting that the reason it was so hard to get that approved was that if anything did go wrong, if your navigation is off or if you encounter any trouble, you're really out of luck?
Well, we could have landed at Thule, although it was 0-0 there. That would have been a tough job. Thule, Greenland. But, you know, I don't know why things were approved or disapproved. There are people that are totally antithetical to any proposal that comes out of the box, perhaps because they don't have an interest in it, or they're resentful that somebody's doing something that, who knows. But persistence wins in the final equation, and we were persistent.
Clearly, you're a persistent guy. But if you had gotten lost, or, God forbid, if you had gone down, there probably wouldn't have been much chance for a rescue in those kind of conditions.
No. In fact, I mentioned that we lost four aircraft between Goose Bay and DW1 Greenland that time, and it was February, and the guy that was leading my flight took off with zero oil pressure in zero conditions, zero visibility, zero ceiling. And we were 100 miles off short of Greenland when his engine quit. A sheet of flame came out the back end, and he jacked it. But there was an undercast below us. Now, there was a, what was called a duck butt, an SA-16 amphibious aircraft on station. And he went down below the undercast, and there was about a 1,000-foot ceiling. But there were 10-foot swells and icy water, I say, February, the Davis Straits. He punched out, as I say, and I saw his parachute descend through the undercast. But no one ever saw anything of him again. So, that, you know, that's, again, part of the deal. You either make it or you don't.
Yeah, and it's clear that you became accustomed to that trade-off pretty early, and you had a lot to go. I know I'm just scratching the surface here. When the Vietnam War broke out, was that something where, because of your combat experience in Korea, you were eager to get over there and fly combat missions?
I was eager to get over there, yes. It took me a while. I was at headquarters, Tactical Air Command at Langley Field, Virginia, and I was working for the Deputy for Operations, General Gordon Graham. One of the things that I was involved in was putting together an Northrop F-5 Freedom Fighter deployment over there to evaluate the F-5 in combat. And I was the project officer working for General Graham and putting that thing together. And the unit was sent over there temporary duty, presumably for 90 days, with a big evaluation team to gather all the data. It was decided at the end of that program to extend the unit's term, make it a permanent installation, fill it up with additional aircraft and more pilots. And I had a call from the personnel guys, and I went upstairs to their office, and he said, I thought you'd be up here in less than a minute. Look, here he is, and here's a job you might want to be the commander of that outfit. And I was just before making lieutenant colonel, and the lieutenant colonel's job is a squadron commander in those days. I went down and asked the general, and he said, no, wrong airplane. And I asked him to think about it, and I come back tomorrow. Remember, he said to me, well, you should be flying Phantoms. I said, I can do that later. He said, what will your wife say? I said, we won't tell her. So,
and you didn't?
I didn't tell her. But anyway, I got the job, and I was really looking forward to that. I've been asked many times, what's the best job in the Air Force? And I said, squadron commander of a fighter squadron in combat. So I was able to command the Scotia Tiger outfit, and then I extended so I could fly Phantoms north.
Yeah. And you flew 400 combat missions in Vietnam?
Mm-hmm. 400 and some. I don't know how many, to tell you the truth. Some of them I didn't think were worth counting.
That's an eye-popping number.
Just the odds. More if they'd let me.
I know you would. But just, I mean, when you step back and think about the odds, I mean, you've already survived over 100 missions in Korea, crazy stuff as a test pilot, 400 missions in Vietnam, taking your life into your hand every time.
Well, that's not my call.
You really did enjoy that work.
Yeah, it's a great job. It's the cutting edge of the sword. You're where it is. It's Horatius at the bridge. It's being there.
If you have 400 of them, there's no one that's typical. But can you give us a taste of what some of those missions were about or like?
Oh, my gosh. You know, it's hard to go back. And of course, shooting down that first MiG-21 was a great experience.
Well, we're going to hear about that experience when we come back. He would earn the Silver Star for those actions in the skies over Vietnam that day, and 2 days later did something that brought him an even more exclusive decoration, the Air Force Cross. Head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for photos of General Titus and links to those medal citations. And we'll hear the rest of his remarkable story when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 800 veterans have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler,
Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors. And presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country, with 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a visit with an accomplished Air Force general, Robert Titus. We've heard how he enlisted in the Army during World War II, became a paratrooper with the 82nd Airborne, was even training to jump into Japan when the first atomic bomb was dropped, so thankfully he never had to make that jump. We heard how he became an Air Force fighter pilot, completing more than 100 missions during the Korean War, his time as a test pilot, including the very first jet mission over the North Pole in 1959. That led to another Distinguished Flying Cross, but now we have the time machine set at 50 years ago. And in the span of 3 days in May of 1967, his aerial exploits in Vietnam earned him 2 of our nation's highest military honors. First, the Silver Star, then 2 days later, the Air Force Cross. Let's start with May 20th, 1967, when you shot down your first MiG in your F-4 Phantom II.
We were escorting some F-105s down what is called Thud Ridge. It's a mountain ridge that runs northwest to southeast right into Hanoi. We were airborne, and I saw a MiG, and I broke off and announced that I was engaging a MiG. He was in a descending turn to the left, and there was mountains in the background. And so the Sidewinders, which are a heat-seeking missile, were not valid at that date and time because of too much background radiation. So I hooked up with a radar homing missile. Now, that was an AIM-7 Sparrow missile, and you'd lock onto the target and transmit information to the missile, and the missile then would guide to the target. However, I fired the first missile, and it didn't guide. I never saw it. And my backseat is saying, fire another one. I fired another one, and it too didn't guide. And I thought I was going to have to ram this guy. But finally, the third missile hit him in the wing root, and he ejected. And I was amazed that he had what looked like a Martin Baker seat, an ejection seat. I thought, oh, wow, he's got the same kind of a ejection seat system that we have. So I was kind of pumped on that.
Yeah, was that kind of a watershed moment for you? Here you'd been in combat in a P-51. You'd been in the F-86 and never had that experience of going toe-to-toe with an enemy fighter like that.
Yeah, well, yeah, it was a thrill because, again, I'd been wanting to shoot down airplanes since I was a kid.
Yeah, well, and there you did. But shooting down 2 in the same mission is bigger than shooting down 1, and you received the Air Force Cross. The only thing higher that you could have gotten is the Medal of Honor. I mean, this is a prestigious, prestigious medal. May 22nd, 1967. It sounds like maybe that same route that you just talked about, huh?
Essentially, yeah. This time I was taking a flight of 8 in to provide cover, and we're heading east toward the target area, as I recall, probably about 16, 17,000 feet, in position to look at the box of F-105s. I don't recall, there were 12 or so of them, 3 flights of 4, as I recall. In any event, there were a couple of instances. I saw a flash out to the sunlight reflecting off other aircraft, obviously, out to my 1 o'clock position, and they went off to the right, and I followed them for a while, and I determined that they were no longer a threat to the strike force, so I was concerned about being in position over the flight, protecting the strike force, so I went back to where I should have been. And I called for a jettison of the external tanks because I'm figuring, okay, the MiGs are up and they're engaging. I looked over my shoulder and I saw 2 MiGs coming up our 6 o'clock position, and they were firing missiles. And I called for a break, went a hard left turn, and then as the MiGs went by, I reversed, and the one went up. I saw the one. I put my pipper on him in the gun sight and got a good growling tone from a Sidewinder missile and released a Sidewinder missile. And it flew right up his tailpipe. He exploded. And then I looked out, and here's another MiG at my 1 o'clock position. So I headed for him, and he then made a hard diving turn, and we went through a series of... This time I had a 61-millimeter gun pod, but I had no computing sight. All I had was a pipper. Anyway, when he finally had to roll out, I put my pipper in front of him and just pulled the trigger and hosed him down the center, and he conveniently crashed. So that was the second one. That's how it was.
Well, here's what the Air Force said about it. They said, the President of the United States of America takes pleasure in presenting the Air Force Cross to Lieutenant Colonel Robert F. Titus for extraordinary heroism in military operations against an opposing armed force as an F-4C mission commander in the 389th Tactical Fighter Squadron, 366th Tactical Fighter Wing, Da Nang Air Base, Vietnam, in action near Hanoi, North Vietnam, on 22 May 1967. On that date, Colonel Titus led his flight into one of the most heavily defended areas of North Vietnam in direct support of F-105 strike aircraft operations. Undaunted by accurate flak and 5 surface-to-air missiles that were launched at his aircraft, he repeatedly and unhesitatingly engaged numerous MiG-21s in defense of the friendly aircraft. During these aggressive and courageous aerial encounters, Colonel Titus destroyed 2 MiG-21 aircraft. As a direct result of his tenacity and extreme bravery in the face of great danger, the F-105 force was able to accomplish its assigned mission. Through his extraordinary heroism, superb airmanship, and aggressiveness in the face of hostile forces, Lieutenant Colonel Titus reflected the highest credit upon himself and the United States Air Force. How's that sound?
Sounds a little inflated, don't you think?
Well, you tell me. You didn't say anything about the 5 surface-to-air missiles launched at your plane.
Well, I was vaguely aware of their presence, but I couldn't concern myself with them. I was occupied with the enemy fighter.
How close do you think they came to you?
I have no idea. There was a lot of flak, I know that. But, again, I was not interested in the flak. My wingman said later, he said, all I can think is I'm watching my squadron commander get shot down. But, you know, my job was to get the MiG.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't he saying that because that was probably the likely outcome of the situation you found yourself in?
It's probably close.
And it would have been probably not just you shot down, but some of those F-105 shot down.
Could have been.
So that incident, you're awarded the Air Force Cross for. Do you take some pride in that? Was it a proud moment when they pinned it on you?
You know, the only thing I can say about combat decorations is that, as I told somebody earlier some years ago, they decorate you for things that you don't think are particularly significant, and the things that you thought were really spectacular that you accomplished, no one noticed.
Well, here's your chance. What are some of those things that no one noticed that when you look back on a career that really has spanned the entire existence of the Air Force, what are the things that you think were noteworthy or you're proud of?
Well, I think when I was flying F-5s in South Vietnam, there was a mission. We were airborne, and I had napalm and 20-millimeter ammo. There was an emergency call. There was a Mike force, which was a long-range reconnaissance force led by Americans using Hnung mercenaries. These were Chinese convicts who had been let out of jail to fight in the war, and they were trained by the Americans, and they were out, and they were surrounded by Viet Cong. And they're in desperate straits. The only problem was it was an undercast, and I was above that. But I responded to the call to the control center. They put me in touch, gave me a frequency so I could contact the guys on the ground. I was whispering into the microphone. Anyway, we've got dead and wounded, and we're surrounded, and I need napalm. And I said, well, I'd be happy to help to the extent that I can, but I can't see. I don't know where you are. And he said, I can hear you. You're south of me. Come north. And anyway, through some activity like that, I let down blind through an undercast. I flew over his position, and I did a 9270 to come back, as I told him, to release some smoke, which he didn't want to do until I was in position. And he released the smoke, and I said, where do you want it in relation to smoke? He said, I want it on the smoke. And I thought, you sure you want it that close? Absolutely. And I put 2 cans of napalm on the smoke. Anyway, they extricated themselves, and that broke the perimeter of enemy. That night, I was in the squadron bar, which was a room about half this size, and there was somebody at the door, a guy in grease paint and soft hat, and he's looking for me. My guy said, what are you looking for him for?
Ready to defend you, huh?
Let him in. He brought a bottle of champagne and a red, white, and blue scarf, which they wore as a present for me, and I became pretty closely associated with those guys after that. But it was a good feeling to know that you were able to help your comrades on the ground. That's what it's all about.
Well, and correct me if I'm wrong, but as I understand that scenario, and we talked earlier about the possibility of friendly fire, when he says, I want it on the smoke, you're saying, well, that might kill you.
That's what I'm thinking.
But you trust him, he trusts you, and in reality, you risked your life coming down blind through that overcast to that position to save theirs.
Well, the job is there, you know. The devil take the hindmost. You've got to do the best you can to provide the support that he requires. That's the camaraderie. That's what it's all about. You know, to me, I just get down to that's what is, and it's never occurred to me to deviate from that thought process.
And you were in the Air Force with that rank of Brigadier General, but that didn't end your flying days by any means.
No, I flew up until the day before I retired.
And the impact of the F-15 program, I mean, these are planes that are still in use today.
Great airplane.
What was your role in the development and deployment of F-15s?
When I was a major at TAC headquarters, working for General Graham, he called me in one day and said, write a general operational requirement for a new air superiority fighter. And we got to be able to beat the MiGs in Europe. At that time, of course, Russia and the Eastern Bloc was our predominant enemy. So we set out to put together, well, I wrote a requirement with his approval, establishing the performance parameters of an air superiority fighter. And then I went to Vietnam, and 2 years later when I came back, they assigned me to the Pentagon to be the program element monitor for the concept formulation of the F-15. And I hired some guys that I knew that I felt were the best that I could find, and Gary Willard, Riccioni, who taught astrophysics at the Academy, who'd been an instructor in the test pilot school and competent in their understanding of fighter aviation. John Boyd was already there. He was the father of energy maneuverability, which was a very good tool for defining performance. We spent a lot of time talking to the contractors and gaining approval within the Air Force system. We had the approval of the Commander of Tactical Air Command, and the approval of the General Ferguson, the head of Air Force Systems Command, and the rest of it was feeding information to the people who were trying to exercise their own authority in the process, but had not a word to do with it. We're briefing Senator Goldwater and Senator Cannon, got them on board with us, and I knew we essentially were going to get approval because we had all the firepower we needed. Republic, Fairchild Hiller, Lockheed, McDonnell Douglas, Boeing, any number of companies were interested. Anyway, they had a competition, and McDonnell Douglas selected, and the job was done. 2 years later, the airplane first flight occurred. We took the contract in 70. First flight was in 72. Initial operational capability, first operational squadron, 1975. That's fast compared to today. F-35's been in design and production for forever, and now they cost Lord knows how much each.
Is there something about how the F-15 turned out or the impact globally of the F-15's effectiveness that you take specific pride in?
Well, I think it's a great airplane. We designed it to be. Remember, we used to say you can do a 3G turn and climb it to 30,000 feet a minute, and that'll roll your socks down. And at the time, first flight, as I say, in 1972, it was a remarkable level of performance. I mean, it's a Mach 2 airplane, right? What are they building today? Mach 2 airplanes.
Yeah.
40 years later.
Yeah.
More than 40 years later. So, you know, we've pushed the envelope pretty much as far as it can go in terms of air-breathing fighters. Yeah, they can pull high Gs now, and they can go negative, and they can do all kinds of things. And they've got $100,000 helmets so they can see below them and right behind them and all that. And I'm asking, who's the designated enemy? We knew what the requirement was for an F-15. We defined an airplane to meet that requirement. Mm-hmm. I've talked to the project officer on the F-22 and told me all the things it could do. And this was 10 years ago, I suppose. And I said, but what is the requirement for that airplane? Well, it has stealth. And what is the requirement?
Right.
Can you give me the answer to that question? Well, they send them to Alaska and give them to the Hawaiian Air National Guard. And I'm thinking, I'm missing something. Who's the enemy? And who's the enemy for the F-35? I don't know. Not guys with rocket-propelled grenades and IEDs.
And the contrast that you're outlining is when you were working on the F-15, you knew exactly what you needed to do, stay one step ahead of the Russians, right?
Right.
It's a hard turn from the F-15 back to the P-51, but 60 years after you made the last P-51 flight, you went up in a Mustang again?
Indeed, I did, and that was a wonderful experience to go out there to Petaluma and engage in that event. And I enjoyed getting in the cockpit, you know, the smell of the glycol. I had an experience some years ago. This had to be at about 1971 or 72 when I was stationed with the 1st Fighter Wing down at MacDill Air Force Base in Florida. And we stopped on the way back from a trip back east at Tyndall Air Force Base in the Panhandle of Florida. And I spent the night there and went out to my Phantom the next day. And there was a sergeant there who was obviously pretty close to retirement. And there was a Mustang parked across from my airplane. I went out and looked in the cockpit, smelled the glycol, and walked back to my airplane. And the sergeant said, now, I'm sure he must have been in World War II. He said, you used to fly those, didn't you, Colonel? I said, well, as a matter of fact, I did. How'd you know? He said, I saw you patted on the tail when you walked away. I said, it brings back memories. Yeah, I loved flying that airplane.
Well, you mentioned the smell. How about the sound?
Great sound. I was walking down in the stadium one day at a football game, and 3 Mustangs came through, and I stopped and grabbed my throat. I clutched up, and my wife said, it's okay, honey. I said, you don't know what a thrill that is. Another time I was at Goose Bay Labrador, and I heard the pop, 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 and I looked up, and I thought, Mustang. No, it was a transport aircraft with 4 Merlin engines.
You've had an incredible career, and I imagine there isn't much that you have not done. But is there one aircraft or one experience that you haven't had that you would still like to have at age 90?
I can't say that I need to go back. You know, I don't live in yesterday, and I don't worry about tomorrow. Who's the famous Chinese philosopher who said, yesterday is depression, tomorrow's anxiety, live for the moment? And I kind of conduct myself in that light. I'm not concerned about things that I could have done or things that I didn't do. I've enjoyed the things I've had the opportunity to do and the people that I've gotten to know. And I have great memories of great Air Force fighter pilots, Navy fighter pilots, Marine fighter pilots, great soldiers. I've had some marvelous associations with some of the finest military people that have ever served. And that, to me, is my greatest experience.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because I was going to ask you. I know there are a lot of people that look up to you. But who would you say are the people that you see as heroes or role models or people who should be celebrated?
Well, my 82nd Airborne Division Commander, General Jim Gavin, who jumped into Normandy as a 38-year-old Major General with the 82nd Airborne Division and led the victory parade up Fifth Avenue, later became Ambassador to France, was a hero. And he was a hero to me because I remember standing out with the entire division on parade at Fort Bragg. The senior officers were arriving in their staff cars and going into the reviewing stand. We're all just standing there waiting for the parade to start, and somebody realized that here comes a lone figure off in the distance walking toward the reviewing stand. No one realized what it was initially, but then the word, that's General Gavin. And I thought, wow, what an exemplary display of leadership. Made me real proud and taught me a lesson, valuable lesson. Of course, General Graham, who I worked for in the Pentagon, and I worked for him when I did the polar flight. He was a colonel in the Pentagon at that time. He was my contact point, and I became very associated with him, and I later on worked for him in Japan, and he was a phenomenal guy. The fighter pilot's fighter pilot, he was known as. Great deal of respect for him and others. Jim Hill, who was a commander of Space Command, Air Force fighter ace in World War II, and a lot of test pilots. And I knew all the test pilots back in the 50s from the various companies, you know.
Yeah.
Jaeger and Everest and Dude Haynes and Tony Levere, and I could go on and on and on. The Society of Experimental Test Pilots, which I was associated with. Bob Hoover, a good friend who died recently. Bud Anderson, great fighter pilot, boss of mine on two separate occasions.
On the flip side of that, you have counseled, advised, mentored so many young pilots, guys coming through the Air Force Academy here in Colorado Springs. What's the most important advice that you can share for those young people who are going to make that choice to put their lives on the line?
Well, I give them the same old story, you know. Guide yourself by the cardinal virtues. Remember, duty. As Robert E. Lee said, duty is the most sublime word in the English language. No one can do more. No one should ever expect to do less. That's what I told Chad Hennings and any number of other football players that I sponsored at the Academy. Chad and I still are in contact. I talked with Chad the other day. And, you know, he went on to win three Super Bowl rings.
Yeah.
At the Dallas Cowboys. Great man. A man of high integrity and honor and self-discipline. And that's what I, as Chad talks about, the hot tub lectures.
Maybe this is a tough question, and as I work to it, I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country for so long and for taking the time to share a few of your experiences with us. Is there something that you would say that you are most proud of?
It's a privilege to serve your country and honor God. That's all there is.
And I can see in your eyes that you mean that with every ounce of your being.
Well, God and family.
Is there anything else I didn't ask you about that you want people to hear?
I can't imagine that I've got much to tell anybody.
Well, I think we all know better than that by now. General Robert Titus, 90 years old. You'll find photos and other links at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. There is one story we didn't hear, how he acquired the nickname Earthquake. He insists it was just randomly assigned early on in his pilot days because he didn't have a nickname. My theory, maybe it was simply foreshadowing what would truly become a groundbreaking career. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, And then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that honor flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.